Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/campaign to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
In this episode, Charlie Keevers, CFO at Carta, talks about motivating his team through hard problems and autonomy, the importance of context sharing in leadership, and why moving fast is his top priority when selecting new technology. Hi, I'm Ross, and this is the CFO Playbook, where each week you'll get insights from world-class financial leaders to help you grow your company, yourself, and face the challenges required of today's CFO. Before we jump into the interview, we want to invite you, our listeners, to head to our show notes to find a link to our listener survey. We want to learn about how to make the CFO Playbook even better. As a thank you, you'll have the opportunity to win your choice of an iPad or a Samsung Galaxy Tab S7. We'd love your feedback. So Charlie, nice to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, I'd love to explore your journey to where you are now, which is as CFO at Carta. Because you've had a very interesting journey that started off, of course, many moons ago in audit, but actually you then spent time in consulting before moving into M&A and then went through some big tech companies before moving to hypergrowth and doing all of that across lots of different locations internationally. It's a fascinating career path. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to your current role at Carta?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I'd say is I knew pretty early on I wanted to go down the finance path. The path wasn't very straight, but I was very willing early on to try a few different things. And I enjoyed deeply my career in consulting. It was absolutely the right choice for me out of college. And that gave me exposure to a lot of different businesses and a lot of different CFOs and CEOs and a lot of different executives, which really shaped me in the ways I thought about future opportunities. And really what I learned is getting exposure to more things would be better early in my career. So decided to go back to business school. That gave me the opportunity to, from a broadening my perspective, to go working internationally. And that's where I started in Europe, spent a little bit of time in the United States in my early career. Had not really worked in Asia a lot. I worked with some clients, but not had spent time locally. Decided to do that post-business school. So I spent close to 2 years in South Korea working for Samsung. And that was a great experience, first to learn how Chaebol, like Samsung works, how the local markets operate, like South Korea, and broadly how more of Asia operates from a business standpoint. So I really got great learnings from that. And then got the opportunity to come back to the United States to become an investment banker. Quickly found out that's not what I wanted to do long-term, so decided to make the move in-house, which was also in 2008 when banks happened to be in a tougher spot. Not saying I saw it coming, but definitely the timing turned out pretty well for me. And that's where I started to be more focused on initially a mix of strategy and mergers and acquisitions, and basically leveraging my experience as a consultant and adding on top my experience as a banker. So really bringing together everything I'd done and doing it for a large corporation like HP. After a little bit of time, I actually spent 2 years in the investor relations seat at HP as well, which was one of the most formative experiences I've had. I definitely not something that was on my list of careers or roles to take. But I would highly recommend it to anybody who wants to be a CFO, whether private or public. It just teaches you a lot of skills that are tough to build otherwise in terms of understanding how investors approach their investments, how to communicate to them, and kind of that whole aspect of the CFO job, which is a big piece of what I do today. A couple of rough years at HP, we had four different CEOs in the 2 years I was there. So you can imagine my discussions weren't always very positive with investors, which was also a great learning experience. I had the opportunity to join Salesforce, which at the time was still like a newer, large, but up and coming software company, to join their M&A team. And did that for a few years. And similarly there, learned a ton about the SaaS business model and kind of building an ecosystem like Salesforce has done. That's when I started to like focus a bit more on realizing M&A long-term wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do, and really wanted to continue to work more closely to all the financial pieces of the business. And also wanted to continue to broaden my perspective on different business models. So joined Lending Club, which was a big fintech company that had just gone public at the time. I effectively started lending online, which is like pretty new at the time. And similarly there, learned a lot around what it means to run a fintech company, around compliance and risk management. And it's a different thinking from a pure software company. After a few years, get the itch of starting to take a more senior role, got connected to Henry, the founder of Carta. We happened to have a very similar view of the world and you know, quickly realized we'd likely work well together. And also Carta just happens to be a mix of everything I've done. It's for the finance community, so it's pretty unique to be the finance person at a company focused on finance problems. And so my team and I are actually more involved than I ever thought I would be in product and strategy, just because we have a perspective on that. And it mixes the software components, the capital markets components, and the fintech components of everything I've done in the past. So it's tough not to find some attraction in that. And it certainly hasn't disappointed in my almost 5 years there.
It's a fascinating journey. And there's so many pieces I'd love to explore a bit further. The first one is the tough period at HP. Because HP at that time, I'm not sure who the four were, but HP is such a colossus of a company. But we actually had a guest on recently that spent a long time at HP as well. And they commented on the fact that HP perhaps missed a few important waves of technology that led to their business being under pressure, which probably in turn led to the need for transformation and the need for all of those CEOs in that process. But what was that like for you then, trying to build confidence like in the investor community against presumably such critique or concern about company strategy? Because as you said, formative experience, but extremely tough.
I think what it really taught me is a few things. First, it was a very complex business. It's a massive company with hundreds of thousands of employees. And just first, like, how do you distill that information to investors? How do you explain to them the breadth of a business like this and help them understand what type of asset they're buying as investors? That was learning number one that I've continued to use further in my career. And frankly, Carta now is becoming complex enough that I'm finding myself really leveraging a lot of those skills. Then second is really just to go back to the basics as to what problems HP was solving at the time, right? And explaining to investors, here's what we solve. And yes, there are issues here and here's what we're doing about it. And that's the other piece, being really transparent. Like that's another thing I've learned from mentors and from that job, is no point in trying to hide things. Just be as transparent as you can. It doesn't mean you have to talk about everything, but be as transparent as you can so people understand your thought process, understand what you're going through, and lay out your plan. And that's something we continue to do here at Carta. And we're very transparent with our board and our investors on what's working, what's not working. And I learned that during my time at HP, because you build trust and confidence, and that's really important, those relationships. Like investors are, of course, looking at, is this an asset that we'll appreciate? But a big part of it is also, do I believe in the team running the company? And do I believe in the team behind it? And that only comes if know that they can believe what you're saying, if they can trust that you will share enough information for them to make the right decision. So it was a lot of all these dynamics. And yes, through good and bad, it really came down to like, yeah, we know this didn't go well and here's what we're doing about it. And just being very kind of objective as possible and not trying to be defensive.
And how do you get that balance right where about what to share and where? Because it's such a tricky one, especially with investors, because, and Carta's now like very established, like really significant valuation and really developing as a company. But there are periods where you're incubating new businesses or you're setting up a new team or a new process, and you're just not ready to share that data yet because it's not there. So on one side, you want to make sure that you've got something robust to share with investors. But on the other side, you want to be transparent and not hide things away and then dent confidence. How do you strike that balance?
part of it is explaining, in my experience, explaining is just the process you go through. And so being very clear that there will always be things we're trying, and partly being in a company that is built on innovation, if you're not trying things, you're not going to continue to grow, right? That's what we all get paid to do by our investors, is continue to grow this business by finding new ways to grow it and change how certain things are done. And we've been lucky enough to do this across a variety of services and solutions we have for finance teams. I think it's really about this, explaining your process, explaining how you approach company building. It doesn't mean you need to give all the details of like, this project didn't work and we're investing these exact number of dollars here, but more like, here's how we're going to build. We're going to have these established businesses. We're going to continue to build and frankly, start to focus on optimizing. And here are a few projects that we don't know yet if they're going to work. Here's why we think they're worth investing in. And we're going to keep you updated on the progress. And just like, overall broad stroke levels of progress, just that helps so people don't feel like there are any surprises. And I think it's just, everybody knows certain things works, others don't work. I think it's unrealistic to say, no, everything's perfect. Like everything we do is a great investment. And so I think it's also part of just building that trust that people know that once they're investors, they're partners with you, and just like treat them as such and make sure they also can help you. And I think that's the mistake I made early in my career, is always thinking, the investor is kind of like the teacher. Like you can never, like nothing's wrong. Like my exam is perfect. And I realized, and definitely at Carta, was like, they all know that things will go wrong and they want to be here to help. And if you don't give them that visibility, they can't help you. And so that's been super interesting. And frankly, I have to say, it's been very beneficial to us to be as open as we can with our investor base, because we've gotten a ton of help from it. And now I think I'm at a really good spot in terms of having a good, productive relationship with our board and our broader investor base.
And what about the aspect of the relationship with those investors, where, of course, they're a partner, they want you to succeed, if you succeed, they succeed, and so forth. But there's always potential negotiation over future valuations and investments and so forth. That's part of the game, especially in hyper growth companies like Carta. So, and when you give away all information, where you to open up everything, you give away leverage and negotiations as well. So how do you, again, balance that trade-off?
It's, you know, not necessarily going too far ahead in terms of being, providing all, every single detail of the things that went wrong, but it's just like keeping it at a high level. Of course, highlighting the bigger investments you're making, the bigger mistakes. And then, I mean, we took a slightly different tack on all these negotiation tactics. We're actually active in the market in terms of secondaries pretty often. And so we have plenty of ways to check what people believe our value is beyond our existing investors. And so, yeah, we're not necessarily letting insiders only kind of setting our value. And so, and that's the balance too, is making sure you continue to get external perspective on what you're doing. And hopefully you have enough alignment with your existing investors that you can get to the right valuation that makes sense for both existing investors in the company. The way we kept everybody honest is about always bringing new investors in and making sure there was enough of a, hey, these guys believe this is the value. You believe this. Tell me why there's a difference. And so that helped just make all these discussions go away, frankly, and everybody's quickly aligned on like, okay, what does the market believe? And what is the business worth based on how it's performing and its future prospects?
So when you're mentioning that they're the secondary market, that ties in, of course, I presume, into Carta X and mm-hmm. what you've released and done then. Can you explain a little bit about Carta X, how that works, and also how that adjusts the dynamic that you just explained between your investors and how you go about your fundraising rounds?
The simplest way to think about Carta X, it's a liquidity platform. And so what we do is, right now it's only available to existing Carta customers, mostly because we leverage a lot of the existing information that we have on them, on their capital structure, cap table, and everything that's equity related to run these transactions, and both on the front end and the back end, make that a lot smoother for all the participants. If we don't have that information, it becomes super manual, and frankly, we're no better than other solutions out there. So what we do is a variety of transaction types that just enable our customers to run secondaries, which can be on the back end of them raising primary capital, but also completely outside of a transaction. It can be a block trade, can be a tender offer. The more evolved version of it that we have, which we did last year, is a form of marketplace. Think of a very simple auction process where you build a sell side book and a buy side book and effectively find a clearing price based on what the market says the prices. And so that's been super interesting. And we actually raised our round last year, our Series G, based on running an auction process on our own stock in January of 2021, and then raised some money in the summer using that valuation. So effectively, this was the value was not determined through negotiations. It was determined by the market. And so that's what we're testing. And that's why we think this is the way to the future, that just having a few well-informed investors set the value will evolve. The other thing we're seeing change is that liquidity at private companies becomes a real topic. And with, I mean, the last few years were a great example that exploded in the market. And now a lot of employees have tasted what it means. And frankly, it's been important for retention for us. We do two or three of these a year, mostly because it's really important from an employee standpoint for us to be able to do that. And with the talent acquisition challenges being what they are for everybody, I'm seeing a lot of my peers really think about this a lot more aggressively. And that's why we're trying to put in place something that helps everybody do that quite easily.
So for an employee at Carta, does that mean that they can then, if they've acquired RSUs and stock over a period of time, that they are able to cash out on that throughout the period of time through secondary markets and not rely on the famous IPO and go into the street?
That's right. That's right. And of course, it's, you can't sell all your shares. Like, we're also still concerned about retaining our best employees, of course, but they can sell a portion of their vested shares. And so for employees that have been with us for a few years, that's enabled many of them to make some larger capital purchases that otherwise they'd have to wait for. And for us, it's part of our ethos. Like, we want to make all this easier. And so, of course, we need to model that behavior, but we also believe strongly that's the way to the future. We've always, as a company and as a management team, been surprised of the bright line of the IPO. Why does it have to be this way, right? Why is it like the only liquidity event? And you basically go from being completely non-liquid, and then suddenly you're hyper-liquid in the public markets with all the things that it means. And why isn't there something intermediate and frankly more of a gray area of transitioning where you get more and more liquid over time? And frankly, that's what people do ahead of a direct listing. They generally encourage secondary trading activity to get a sense of what the price is in the market so they can set the reference price. And so it's a lot of developments in capital markets and the private space that we think are really interesting and that we want to help further and again be an example of. And yeah, for us, it's certainly helped with attracting and retaining employees. And right now, this is a top priority for us.
And not just you, for everyone. And we'll touch on that it's rare to speak to any CFO or any leader that isn't focused on retaining the best and finding the best.
That's right. I'm not surprised, yes.
Yeah, probably always a focus, but it's particularly challenging now. It's really interesting hearing you talk about Carta X, because having experienced it at Dropbox, I was at Dropbox prior to going public and then the period of going public. And naturally, prior to going public, we were trying to get the timing right, the story right, get the business model into the right shape. I'm sure in the background, we had an amazing finance team there. They were finessing all of the metrics to look beautiful in the narrative. But what was interesting about it amongst the broader team is there was so much like pent-up pressure of people waiting for the exit. And it wasn't that there was just like an outflow of people straight after going IPO. It wasn't like that. But so many people had invested or had vested a lot of stock there, and they wanted to, some of them wanted to have that because it could change their lives or do whatever. But it led to an unhealthy fixation on an event. And so even if there was speculation, which there always was around an acquisition, Microsoft are going to buy us or whatever it was, it led to the wrong focus not being on the customer and the product and the business. And it was more about, is the event coming? So I can completely see the value of that gray area as you describe it.
Great example. And you're right. We've given everybody an understanding that we do at least two of these a year. Then just continue to focus on doing the best thing for the customer and don't worry about it. And I think at this point, we have enough credibility because we've done, what, 6 or 7 transactions. So it's not like we're saying we're going to do it and maybe, and we keep pushing it off, which sometimes happens. We've been lucky enough to be able to do it. And to your point around kind of getting the story right, it forces me and the rest of the team to just engage with investors and tell that story now. And that's where like being transparent is important. We know why we're not quite ready to go public, because we're still building a lot of things, and doing this in the public eye, given my experience, not necessarily something I want to do. Doesn't mean like that we'll see how the company evolves and what we'll do in the future. But right now we feel great about where we are and continue to bring on new investors that way. And that for me has been great. It enabled me to continue to engage with investors regularly, get feedback from them around what they like about the story, what they don't like. And frankly, it's slowly preparing us to be a more liquid company in whatever form that is. So if one day we choose to go, I think we'll be quite ready because I effectively have to talk to investors regularly now. And we're not quite doing our earnings calls, but this is definitely we're sharing our performance and therefore I have to explain it. And so in small ways, we're slowly building some of the muscle that would be required if we ever were public.
Do you think that the model that you're trying to build will become the de facto standard model for most private companies and scale-ups?
I think the last couple of years I've pushed it more in that direction. And what I mean by that is it's getting, with the talent market being what it is, it's getting tough for companies to just say, nope, no liquidity until we go public. Because employees now start to expect it. I think a lot of people are realizing now over the last few years, capital was plentiful. Still plenty of capital in the private markets. I don't want to say it's drying up at all, but the dynamics have changed with the public markets being what they are. And everybody's raised a lot of money, which is great, which means everybody has runways for a long time. But now with all the funds that people raised in the last couple of years, and oftentimes did secondaries related to these funding rounds, because they had so much investor interest. Now, what do you do when employees come back and say, hey, can we do this again? This was great. Can we do it again? And I think it will force a lot of companies to think about it. So I think it's a long-term change. But we believe that this is the path it's taking. And the best employees will want to work for companies that have some form of liquidity. And again, that war for talent is what's going to shift behavior. Just the way, frankly, it's no different than when people started to issue stock options. That is why people started doing it, is to attract the best engineers. And then a lot of the technology businesses started to do it because that's how they had to compete. And so I think that's what will be interesting to observe, is how does that behavior change and how do different businesses adapt to that. We're definitely seeing, probably have a biased view because a lot of our customers are similar to us, but a lot of our customers are thinking through, okay, how do we do this? How do we have at least one event a year, and how do we start to plan around that?
It's fascinating because I've not yet seen it move through into people's employer brand and how they're trying to promote themselves. What you do see is the flexible working, that like many of the big companies, auditors, consulting companies are going that way. But I guess the point at which companies are promoting that as a key perk, that's when you start to see the tide turn, because it'll become really top of mind for many candidates.
Absolutely. That's why this is a multi-year shift, but I think it's really strongly believed that the bright line on the IPO, I think over time will disappear. Again, the IPO has absolutely a place and people will continue to go public. But I think that's just like not liquid, extremely liquid. That distinction, kind of that binary situation will evolve.
And speaking, like switching over to Carta as well, so you're leading a finance team, building a finance team for a company that's creating products that are designed for finance. And so in the past, of course, you would be expected to be a steward and custodian for any company, but now you might also have a little bit of guidance into product strategy, what the quality of product execution, even things like product marketing and campaigns. How do you and your team, as the ideal customer, get involved in that in Carta?
It's actually a pretty seamless process where we test everything that's new. So when the liquidity platform was a new thing, we were the first ones to use it and went through a detailed review of everything, of all of our observations with the teams. Similarly, we're now what would be an enterprise customer for Carta. We still have a lot of smaller businesses we support, and that's where we do really well. And now my team, especially my accounting team, gives a ton of feedback on like, here are the things we would need to see as we continue to scale, the types of reports and financial reporting needs to look like this, stock-based compensation calculations. And so we already have a great foundation. It's just how do you continue to make it even better and even more seamless for customers like us? And then, yeah, in everything we do, if it really touches directly on finance topics, because we're starting to do more things for the people teams as well, it's oftentimes like somebody from my team and myself will be pulled back by the product team just to get feedback. And interestingly, a lot of people broadly at the company are finance people. We have a lot of CPAs in many parts of the company. We have a lot of CEPs. I mean, a lot of folks who understand equity and finance broadly. So it's actually fun also to be the CFO at a company where everybody cares about finance. They all ask about the performance of the business. They all ask questions about the balance sheet, about the P&L. And it's not that these these random statements nobody understands. And so that's also been fun. I think for my team and myself, just feel like we're at a company that where everybody cares about the financial well-being and the financial performance of the company. And so we actually do a quarterly review, or we review all our financials with the whole company and always get a ton of questions. So it's an interesting process.
I was going to say that, like, you know, you need to be careful what you wish for, because you're not going to, it's not going to be softball questions you're going to get from that crowd.
I know. But again, this is great learning, right? It's like, you know, how do you handle, we're very transparent as a company, and which candidly was a challenge for me in the early days. Like, I come from a, when finance, we don't necessarily disclose everything and we'll let you know what you need to know. Here, we literally go through the majority of our board deck with our employees, what we can share. And especially all the finance performance of it, we're going through it every quarter. And yeah, we're getting a ton of questions, but I think it's good. They're all shareholders. And so we want to treat everybody for what they are, which are not only employees, but also owners of the company. And so I think it's built great culture, and from the standpoint of, like, everybody's expected to care about it, and everybody's expected to understand it. And it's my job and my team's job to make sure it's easy enough to understand for all our employees. It doesn't matter where you work. We should make sure that at least all the big metrics, everything we talk about, you understand what it is and why it matters. And then over time, of course, my job is to make sure my peers and all their teams understand how they impact all these metrics and kind of tie everything back together. But that's why we want to be quite transparent and talk about this regularly.
And within that, you're talking about, of course, there are lots of people with finance background across the company. So that creates a really interesting opportunity for career paths, either for you to recruit people from different parts of the company, or of course, for some of your team to go into very different roles that in other companies, they wouldn't have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I've got the example of both, where on my team, we recruited. So we have a team that does valuations, 409 evaluations for a lot of our customers. Well, I've had one of the members from that team join our finance team, and he's now on to other things at the company. I've had one of my team members on the strategic finance team join our product team. So you're right. Like, we're still a bit early in that phase, just because I think we're getting to that scale as a business where we can do more of that rotation. But absolutely, there's definitely a lot more opportunity. And that is 100% something that helps me in recruiting, is explaining what role anybody would play in their finance capacity at a company like Carta. And it's made it easier to attract and retain great talent.
And on that topic, we mentioned it earlier on, attracting and retaining the best talent, of course, is clearly a priority for you. What are some of the things that you're trying to do as a leader within the business, but also as a leader of finance, to try and make sure that the in particular, the finance team is as strong as it possibly can?
To me, I mean, a lot of it is, and this is highly influenced by mentors and bosses I've had in the past, is really make sure that people understand they'll be given hard problems to solve and they'll be given autonomy to do that. And it's, of course, we want to make sure we look at all the aspects of engagement. And so I don't want to dismiss all these other aspects that are really key to making sure you also get continuous feedback from your team. But what I've found is, in the end, this is one of the top things that matters. And of course, compensation is going to be right. A lot of these basics have to be taken care of. But if you put people in front of hard problems, the best people want to go solve hard problems. And we were lucky enough to be in a place where we still have a lot of hard problems to solve. And I know that's what's keeping me engaged and continually excited about our future, is that I get to work on really hard stuff. But also, my job is to give them the support, but also the autonomy to go solve it. And, you know, I don't want to micromanage. If I hire the best, they should be able to figure it out. But with my support, of course, I don't expect them to know everything. And that so far has worked well. And I've been really lucky to have a strong set of folks join the company.
And then the way that you're leading the team, so you're talking about coaching the team and helping create the right environment. How would you describe your approach to leadership? Because, of course, again, you've got so many responsibilities as a CFO, both external and internal. You've got the nature of a fast-growing company, a hyper-growth company. And then you've got, of course, the pandemic throwing into the mix a whole bunch of other challenges. So it'd be fascinating to hear how you've led and also how you would describe your approach to leadership during that period.
The starting point for me is generally information sharing and context sharing. I can't expect my team to go make the right decisions if I don't give them enough context. So that's the first thing I try to do. Not always perfect, but trying to make sure that my team has a good understanding of what's happening and why, and especially if we go do new things, have enough of an explanation as to why we decided to do it. And so that context building, I think, is really critical, especially when we're not in the office together and we people don't have these chats and just do those, you know, little catch-ups and so they understand a little bit what's going on. So we've made a more concerted effort to have regular touch points. So I'm talking to my full team every week in small increments. So we're doing bigger meetings on a regular basis, but we have at least one quick stand-up every week with the full finance team. And that is generally me telling them, here's what happened this week. Here are the big topics. Any other big updates from other leaders of the team? And just that, I heard from my team very clearly, we don't want more meetings. We're already in meetings all day. But I've gotten good feedback on like it's 15 minutes, first meeting of the day on Friday. And so it's end of the week. We can give them a quick debrief on what happened. And also, they all feel like they're still connected to all their colleagues. And so simple things like that have made a difference. And in terms of how I'm working with my leadership team, frankly, it's how do I help them do the best they can? Like I'm of course working with them and giving them input, but they're all more experts at their own craft than I am. The person who oversees accounting and all their operations, he's way better at this than I am. The person who oversees strategic finance, she has a much better mind on how to think about process and planning than I am. The person who runs our treasury team, and for us at Carta, treasury is very operational. We move a lot of money, so there's a lot of interactions with our R&D team. She is 10x better than me at this. But for me, it's like, how do I help them understand everything else that's going on? Again, the context, and help them think through all the challenges they're faced with and kind of remove some of the hurdles they may be faced with, and then challenge them to take on more. Challenge them to take on a bigger scope and more complex problems. And so far, that's worked well. And my job is to push them to do the same with their teams, right? It's really continuously trying to push everybody up in terms of what they can do. And it was challenging to do this during the pandemic. I think we found a good way to do it. Luckily, my team was already distributed prior to the pandemic. We're already spread across a few offices. So Zoom was already a pretty common tool we were using. So it wasn't a complete disruption. But it's been interesting to onboard people that we've never met. And I think I've been really impressed with the resiliency of the team. And frankly, the whole company through this. And we're actually going back to the office in April. So we'll see how that goes. 2 days a week. So we're not going too aggressive yet. But excited to get back in person.
I was actually going to ask that. So the approach with going back to the office or trying to the manage this hybrid world, you want to go back 2 days a week starting in April, but have you also adjusted perhaps where you're hiring from and the talent pools? Have you started to consider more remote work as well?
For sure. We've greatly increased the amount of remote employees. We still keep somewhat of a cap because we believe we'll still be partly in the office. So we've expanded a little bit, definitely some of the markets that we're recruiting from. And so that's making us think about real estate needs and all these things. But we have absolutely increased the number of remote employees. And frankly, just the bar is simply like, is this a really hard to find position? And that's very true for many of our engineering roles, but it can be true for some of the more technical roles in finance, where we generally keep the remote kind of ask for the hard to find roles. But part of it is also we're testing our way through this, and we're trying to keep some constraints to force people to think through it versus just hire anybody you want remote to force a little bit of discipline. But also we generally do a good job reacting to data. And if we see a lot of interest and a lot of great talent remotely, I mean, I'm sure we'll continue to evolve and see what works best for us. And we already have employees outside of the United States, so definitely leveraging international markets. And so all of that, yeah, has been a big change. And we're continuing to see what it means also from a compensation standpoint and how do we think through all those aspects, which I know is a challenge for many of my peers as well.
Yeah, and there are so many companies now that are set up to solve exactly that challenge. It's trying True. To sell new payroll and associated fintech products in to try and allow you to hire whoever you want, wherever you want. It's a fascinating ecosystem, which leads me on to actually the next topic, which is around technology, of course. Mm-hmm. And you are pioneering a new category of technologies that's designed and intended for finance to use and for companies to manage their finances. How do you approach that use of technology within your team, within finance at Carta? Because of course you're using all of Carta's own products. You're testing it before it even gets out into the wild. But are you equally enthusiastic about trying to adopt other technologies as well to support finance and doing things better and more efficiently?
Absolutely. Every time somebody wants to hire a person, my first question is like, have we thought about any type of software we can use to do this? And it doesn't mean it solves everything, just to be clear. We've grown the team quite a bit. But that's always a question. When we look at our plans every year, every quarter, like let's really, you know, challenge ourselves. Do we need to add yet another person to do this role? Do we need to add another person to go manage this process? And so it's an ongoing process. I don't think you're ever done, because the company changes, the needs change. And so since I've been on board, we've done a lot of the basics in the last few years, moving to NetSuite and establishing a good foundation on all aspects of finance. But we continue to evaluate what's needed. And it all starts with like, what's the process? Well, what that process look like? Whatever it may be, quote to cash, planning, like pick whatever process, finance process you want. What does it look like now? What does it need to look like in 2 to 3 years? And therefore, how are we going to solve it? And are there things we can do to the process itself that make it better? Just from the standpoint of how we operate it? Are there systems and pieces of software that help us do that? And so we constantly have a few priorities. Right now, we're really focused on evolving our planning tools. And what we're really focused on is making it really visible and accessible to the rest of the company. As I mentioned, we're quite transparent. And we really want to engage with the broader business on all these things. So it's not just like, you need to ping the finance team to have all this information. And we have it at our fingertips, and it's provided really quickly. I think we need to do a better job, as the team is already doing, in making all this available quickly. Just again, to facilitate faster decision-making. And so that's the thought process, is really looking at a broad perspective. And we've made great strides in improving how we're approaching different processes. It's not necessarily as much about efficiency for me, it's just about how fast we can move. Our lens is generally, does this allow us to move faster? Does this allow us to do more? It's not, to me, it's not about, I have one thing to do. Can I do it with 2 instead of 4 people? That's great. And we're absolutely going to go do that. It's more like, now that I have this process, I can actually go solve this other problem, and I can all, you know, create this new product, and I can create a new revenue stream. So we think about it a little differently, is by optimizing certain things, now we can spend our time doing more things and growing the company. And that's frankly what we've done. The company's gone way more complex. For all great reasons, we find new ways to create revenue. But it also means on the back end, new processes on how do you grow this product and what's the process to collect this. And we have a few different type of customer types, and all this has implications on how we think about our own systems. And frankly, it's been a fun process. Right now, we're also really focused on taking stock of all our business systems and start to have, with a lot of my colleagues, not just us, but a lot of colleagues across kind of our IT teams and our operational teams and sales and marketing, how do we look at all these systems and the data that flows through all of them, and making sure we've gotten so complex so quickly that we kind of reestablish a good foundation, that when we say this is the data point, we all say the same thing. And as I'm sure you know, you'd be surprised how quickly these things diverge if you don't have a common dictionary, if you will.
I remember the first time that anyone had mentioned something like that, a data dictionary. I was like, really, is that necessary? Is it important? And then at the time, the creation of it, like it was a teammate that had to create it. It was so laborious. And then only when there's an absence of it and people are talking about the same thing using different numbers that come from different places, do you realize how painful it is actually? So I completely see that. And it's interesting that you talk about the building the business case around, can you move faster? Because that's not the conventional way to build business cases. The conventional way is cost saving. And then you can also build it around additional revenue, but those are far easier to knock down because the assumptions are so speculative. That's very interesting that you're just looking at the capacity of the team.
I mean, it is cost saving, but in the end, we're basically redeploying that cost quickly to go do other things, right? And so I'm not necessarily trying to get my cost structure just to be smaller. I do want it to be more efficient over time, 100%. But that's how we do it. Like basically with the same number of people and the processes, just do more on the top line. And frankly, I've learned this from Henry, our CEO. That's how he thinks about optimizing the business and how can we do more with what we have? And we constrain it, and here's what you have, and do the most you can with what you have, versus here's something you need to do and spend the less possible, the least amount to do this. It's a slightly different mindset, and it's worked pretty well for us.
And so you mentioned that there's a whole suite of things that you're probably developing in-house that you can't share with us yet because that's private. That's the classic Steve Jobs. We're working on some great things, but we can't share. But of the software that's coming from other providers and other categories, what are the areas that you, that for you are the big bets that you would like to make with your team on the use of technology and software in at Carta?
Yeah, I think what I talked about in terms of there's not one piece of software really. It's a conjunction of many. It's just really making sure we've got the flow of information across the company well mapped. Because it's okay, but clearly we're starting to feel the pains of growing really quickly and building a lot of things fast. That is frankly a really big topic, not just for me, but across several of our functions. And so I'm actually really excited about making progress on that front because I think this sets a really, really good foundation to grow even further. So that's one broad project. And we've picked a few clear kind of use cases we're actually going through and making sure we're improving. And then for the finance team specifically, I mean, as I mentioned, right now we're really focused on planning tools. We just implemented Workday, so it was a really, really heavy lift last year from a payroll and kind of HR standpoint. So really, really big project with the people team. So that's behind us. And now we're just continuing to slowly tweak it. And frankly, I was really impressed how well the team did that for how big a project it is. We actually have built our own billing system for our core business. We're not doing all pieces of the business, but I effectively have a small engineering team that does a lot of that and kind of is supports the broader company. And that helps us to iterate really fast. So that continues to be a big focus for my team and I is how do we talk to the go-to-market teams and understand, okay, what do you want to do from a pricing standpoint, from the packages you want? Like, what does it mean for us to be able to ingest this and actually make the experience of customers interacting with us when they have to like pay bills and get invoices and everything? Just think through that whole quote-to-cash process where we have a much stronger ability to kind of customize things to Carta. So that's been super interesting. And as I mentioned, planning is a big one. We've tried a few different things in the past and have been disappointed with how accessible we've been able to make it. And I know everybody's struggling with this. So, you know, I'm also realistic that we're not going to solve it overnight. But I'm excited to try new technologies that really make all that first, the interaction with the data and the plan and scenario planning a lot easier. And just the access to data to be all come from one central place. So everybody's not trying to dig up data from different places, but also just so people know where they are. And so they don't have to have a finance person tap them on the shoulder and say, did you already spend 50% of your budget and you're only in month one of your quarter? Like that should be like almost pushed to them, right? And that's how we build leverage. And that's how I don't have to have a massive finance team if we can also build the right systems and visibility to that information. Because everybody cares. Everybody wants to know. It's just our job is to make it, to give it to them in a consumable way. So we found a couple of things we're excited about we're implementing right now. We'll see in a few months if our expectations are met.
Well, yeah, exactly. It sounds like you've got a busy year ahead of you.
Yes. Generally, I see this as a good thing. If we have a lot of things to work on, it means we've got a lot of opportunities to go after. So definitely not a complaint.
Exactly. And so Charlie, as we're drawing to a close, I often like to ask, and I would love to ask you too, for anyone who's listening, who is an aspiring CFO, who would like one day to be in that position, what tips, what advice would you give to them so that they could be a success when the time comes?
Reflecting on my experience, I think is just the first one for me is don't be afraid to try a variety of roles. Like, don't think you need to stay. My advice would be if you're an accountant, don't stay in accounting forever and then, you know, expect to become a CFO. If you're an FP&A, same thing, move around, try different things, you know, get exposure to mergers and acquisitions. This is and will continue to be an important role that a CFO needs to understand. Doesn't necessarily need to drive it, but understanding what it means and how to think about it is important. So get exposure to that in whatever fashion you can. Get exposure to talking to investors. And so think about the broader set of skills that you have little exposure to and find a way to get some visibility and some experience on those broader set of skills that are not as obvious. And talking to investors in M&A, you can read as many books as you want. There's no other way to learn it than to experience it. And having done both, yeah, you can learn the theory. The reality is a little different from the theory. Those are two examples that I've had the chance to work on and now are greatly helpful in my current role because these are the things I know how to do and don't have to think about too much. And I'm lucky enough to be able to find you know, people who are really good at getting the numbers right and planning, and there I'm dangerous enough to be able to guide them. So it's really, don't be afraid to try things. One of my reflections on my career is I probably should have taken risk earlier in my career. And I was the typical kind of more finance driven, conservative. And now I'm glad I've taken a bit of a leap of faith when I joined Carta in the earlier days, because that's been a transformative experience. And generally, I would strongly recommend folks take a little more risk earlier in their career, because there's the one thing people, I think, forget also is like careers are long. You can always go do other things. You can always go back to a bigger company, trying a little bit the scaling and the environment we got. You have to figure things out. What's great about big company is you learn a lot, but also everything is already done. You're not going to innovate on a ton on the process. Smaller companies, you're going to figure out a lot of things. And then you have the opportunity to really think through deeply what makes sense for this business versus, well, this is how we've done it for 10 years. Like, why change it? Here, you have to actually go back to the basics. And so I strongly encourage everybody to get that exposure.
I think that's great advice, Charlie, for everyone that's listening. And so I'd like to thank you for joining us today. It's been brilliant to have you on and hear about the wealth of experience at everywhere else, but especially what you're doing at Carta. Just some fascinating stories and lessons for others.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it, Ross.
One last thing. We want to hear from you, our listeners, to learn how we can make the CFO playbook even better. Head to our show notes to find the link to our listener survey. As a thank you, you'll have the opportunity to win your choice of an iPad or a Samsung Galaxy Tab S7. We'd love your feedback. This show is brought to you by Soldo, the brighter way to manage business spending and expenses. With Soldo, you can control every expense, track spend in real time, automate financial reporting, and then use those insights to fuel growth. Learn more at soldo.com.